Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palca reporting. Iraqi troops battling in Ramadi. Iraqi troops battled Tuesday in the center of Ramadi in a fierce push to reclaim the city from Islamic State militants. Sabah al-Numani, a spokesman for Iraq's counterterrorism service, said the fighting was happening in neighborhoods surrounding a government complex with support from the Air Force. Iraqi troops are removing roadside bombs as they try to push forward. Coalition warplanes have carried out airstrikes on Islamic State targets on the outskirts of the city. The loss of Ramadi in May was a major setback for the Iraqi government and the army. The effort to retake the city has taken months, with fighting on the outskirts and work to cut off militant supply lines running into Ramadi. Taliban advances in a rest of province of Afghanistan have prompted Britain to send a group of military advisors to help local forces in countering the insurgents. Ayaz Ghul reports from Islamabad.
For several weeks, Afghan forces and the Taliban have fought in the southern Helmand province. The Islamist insurgency is said to have engaged government forces in several districts, overrunning some of them, although Afghan officials contest those claims. Interior Ministry spokesman Siddiq Siddiqui said Tuesday, reinforcements have been sent to Helmand and confirmed the arrival of British military advisors.
But we ultimately hope that after these measures in place, we will be able to change the situation down there.
The spokesman said government forces are focusing on the Sangin district after repelling insurgent attacks elsewhere. Ayaz Ghul for VOA News, Islamabad.
The UN envoy to Afghanistan, Nicholas Haysom, to emphasize the need for Afghanistan to find a political route to peace. This is VOA News. Bosnian police have arrested 11 people suspected of alleged ties with Islamic State and its militants fighting in Syria and Iraq. Speaking to reporters, a federal police inspector, Marina Zulik, said that the suspects were involved in inciting and organizing terrorist attacks. In this operation, 11 people linked to terrorism, financing of terrorism, inciting and organizing criminal acts, and recruiting fighters for wars in other countries have been arrested. She added that they used private houses for religious gatherings and organized lectures without permission of the Islamic community in the country. The leader of Turkey's main pro-Kurdish party is due to arrive in Moscow on Thursday. The visit comes amid a deepening diplomatic crisis between Moscow and Ankara and will fuel speculation Moscow could be seeking to exploit Turkey's restive Kurdish minority. Dorian Jones has more for VOA from Istanbul.
The leader of Turkey's pro-Kurdish Peace and Democracy Party, Selahattin Demirtas, will be hosted in Moscow by Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Demirtas has said his party intends to open an office in the Russian capital. Vice chairman of TASAM, an Istanbul-based political think tank, says Demirtas' visit will likely sow fears that Russian support could extend beyond Turkey's legal Kurdish movement to the PKK rebel group.
With the PKK, I think the Russians have a long-standing relationship, and maybe they can play with it as a democracy's sword.
Turkey's security forces are currently cracking down heavily on the PKK across Turkey's predominantly Kurdish southeast. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has promised no let-up in the war against the PKK. The International Organization for Migration says the number of migrants and refugees entering Europe in 2015 has gone over the 1 million mark, the largest influx of its kind since the end of World War II. The Geneva-based organization issued figures on Tuesday showing over 1 million migrants from Africa and the Middle East have crossed into the continent by a combination of irregular land and sea routes for a fourfold increase from 2014. The head of the UN's office in Geneva said Tuesday the world body intends to host Syrian peace talks there next month. This is Michael Moeller.
Syria talks will resume in January here in the Palais. No date yet to give you, but it will happen in January.
Geneva was the site of two rounds of UN-brokered peace talks early last year. Russian President Vladimir Putin and Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu have agreed to coordinate their country's actions to fight terrorism in the Middle East. Now, that's according to the Kremlin. The two leaders spoke today by way of phone. This is Joe Palca reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Well, 2015 is proving to be the year that really has changed Europe. There's been 1 million land and sea arrivals as of today. Sea arrivals themselves alone will reach about 1 million probably before the end of this year. So these are really extraordinarily high figures.
That's UN refugee spokesperson Adrian Edwards with the latest figures in Europe's migrant and refugee crisis. Details coming up. Also in the news, voters in the Central African Republic have overwhelmingly backed a constitutional referendum aimed at ending nearly 3 years of political instability. And in Nigeria, the Sultan of Sokoto warns today that government actions taken against the Muslim population could radicalize the nation's large Muslim community. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Burundi, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, Amnesty International says Burundi security forces systematically killed dozens of people in five capital city districts. The violence occurred in Musaga, Mutakura, Nyakabiga, Ngagara, Sibitoki, Jabi, and the Jabi districts on December 11th. In a briefing today, Amnesty calls the killings in Bujumbura the single bloodiest day in Burundi's escalating crisis. The report says some of the nearly 80 dead were victims of extrajudicial killings. It says the targeted districts are mostly inhabited by minority Tutsi. Prior to the December 11th killings, the UN reported more than 300 people have died in the continuing Burundi violence. Yesterday, members of the Burundi parliament voted to reject a proposal by the African Union to send 5,000 peacekeepers to Burundi. The parliament urged the government to maintain its sovereignty and reject the AU force. Reporters Moses Haviramina is in Bujumbura and talked to VOA's William Eagle about the parliament's vote.
Actually, yesterday, the parliament unanimously condemned the deployment of African Union peacekeeping missions in the country. It is said to be Burundi have failed to protect its civilians after the fortnight ago when two military bases were attacked in Burundi, and it seemed to be one of the bloodiest confrontations between the armed group and the security forces since President Nkurunziza's unrest began earlier in April. So what do we see now? All the parliament, the opposition and the ruling party have condemned the decision by the African Union Peace and Security Council to deploy the 5,000 troops in the country. While they're saying the country has been already contributing to Somalia, the second largest contingent in AMISOM, so it still can protect its civilians. The security forces are strong. The security forces are professional. One of the members of the parliament said that the deployment could actually be seen as a violation of the sovereignty of the country and the independence of the country when its people are not supporting the deployment, because this debate was mainly put in place because the Speaker of the Parliament said this debate will issue the stand of the Burundian member of the Parliament to represent the Burundians. But remember that most of the opposition leaders have fled the country. What we have now are these factions of the opposition who were accused of being sympathetic to the government. So most of the political parties here in Burundi have two factions, one which is not recognized by the government, another one which is recognized by the government. So this is how the political system in the parliament is lining up.
So in fact, was there any opposition spokespeople to comment in support of the AU mission, or any NGOs or civil society? Was there any reaction?
Yeah, one of the civil society organization leader whom I talked to yesterday was supporting the deployment of the peacekeeping mission. He said that Burundi has already failed to protect its civilians. If you look at since the April until now, more than 300 people, most especially civilians, have been killed when they were not even armed by the ruling party youth who are called the Imbonerakure. One of the civil society leaders who fled the country told me that the country is not secure and people no longer trust the security forces. I managed to go to one of the areas, the suburbs where the attacks of Friday were made, and I talked to one of the residents there. What he told me is that it could be much better if they could be deployed as soon as possible, because they worry whenever they see police security forces uniforms, it's like they see death in their own face. So residents themselves, they're no longer trusting the security forces.
That was reporter Moses Haviramina in Bujumbura. He spoke with VOA's William Eagle. Voters in the Central African Republic have overwhelmingly backed a constitutional referendum that may help end nearly 3 years of political instability. Election officials say provisional results show that 93% of voters were in favor of the new constitution. It would limit the president to two to five years terms, cut the power of the military, and ensure religious freedom. Election officials, however, say that turnout was only 38%. In the December 13th vote. The election was marred by sporadic violence, with the Red Cross reporting that 5 people were killed and at least 20 others injured on election day. Supporters and opponents of the referendum exchanged gunfire in the capital, Bangui. The referendum is a prelude to national elections that are planned for December 27th. A milestone has been reached in the migrant and refugee crisis. Over 1 million people have fled to Europe this year. The UN Refugee Agency, the UNHCR, and the International Organization for Migration say the number of people displaced by war and conflict is the highest in Western and Central Europe since the 1990s. That's when conflict erupted in the former Yugoslavia. Adrian Edwards is a spokesman for the UNHCR from Geneva. He spoke to VOA's Jody Capua about the flow of people to Europe in 2015.
Well, 2015 is proving to be the year that really has changed Europe. There's been 1 million land and sea arrivals as of today. Sea arrivals themselves alone will reach about 1 million probably before the end of this year. So these are really extraordinarily high figures. Of these number, half are Syrians, 1 in 5 is Afghans, about 7% Iraqis, 80% have come via the Aegean into Greece, 3,600 are dead or missing. These are figures that none of us would have expected to see only 12 months ago.
So there are 1 million people who've come to Europe. So how is Europe faring in handling all these migrants and refugees?
Well, Europe still struggles to find a coordinated, joined-up response that brings stability to the situation. Nonetheless, there have been improvements over recent months. The flow of people coming through Greece, through the Balkans, into other parts of Europe is better managed now than it was. But fundamentally, there are elements to bringing stabilization to the situation that are still missing. The relocation program, so there's some equitable sharing of the burden around Europe, that's still in its infancy. It hasn't taken off fully. We're also worried about the situation this winter in case there are blockages in this movement of people. There's a number of things that have to be looked at. And I think fundamentally, we have to look at the fact that 1 million people almost have come by sea to Europe. There has to be a regularized way of dealing with this so people's lives aren't being put at risk every single day of the year.
So what is a regulated way of handling this?
Well, I think it's very, very important to do several things. One is to try and stabilize the situation in countries where refugees are first arriving. If you look at Lebanon, Jordan, countries around Syria itself, there is increasing poverty amongst refugees in those countries. Children can't go to school. People are having great difficulty. You cannot legally earn a living through work in these countries. And that's encouraging secondary movement of people going on to Europe. So one thing is to fund better these situations, better resource the situation so we can make sure that refugees are in a better situation in their points of arrival. The second thing is looking at what can be done with resettlement, with relocation of people from the region through formal channels. In other words, resettlement programs and other mechanisms that allow people to be safely moved to countries where they can be given safe haven and where the situation can be managed. At the moment, we're without these things, and as a result, we're seeing more and more people on the move. And sadly, without addressing these factors and addressing the root cause of conflict, we're going to see these numbers continuing into 2016.
Earlier in the year, of course, we were spending a lot of time talking about the migrants and refugees fleeing from Libya, making their way across the Mediterranean, if their boats held up, to Italy. What is the current status of that operation?
Well, there's been a spectacular turnaround of trends of Mediterranean movements during 2015. Until the beginning of this year, nearly all the arrivals in Europe were coming via the Libya to Italy routes. That was really where the majority of people came across. Some 219,000 people made that journey in 2014. Now, 2015 has seen that shift of people coming via the Turkey into Greece route predominantly. About 80% of all arrivals this year have been via that route. So people are still seeking refuge in Europe. Others are seeking to migrate to Europe. These are very, very large numbers. And overall, it's still not a situation that's managed sufficiently for the scale of it. And I think that reflects the difficulties that Europe and other parts of the world, too, are having in coming to terms with the fact that we are in an era of much higher levels of mass forced displacement than anything that's been seen in recent years. And that requires a response at a much greater level than anything that's been the norm of recent years.
Does it go beyond the sheer numbers of people that are on the move? Just this week, we heard what was going on in Hungary. There's a campaign underway, apparently by the government, to label or characterize refugees as invaders or terrorists.
Well, I think it's important to recognize this year that if you go away from the headlines and look at what's actually been happening in places where people have been arriving, there are stories after stories of astonishing generosity, people individually helping, huge numbers of volunteers, communities that are actually dealing with refugees as opposed to those which are far from them, really doing extraordinary things to help people. And that has been really quite remarkable and I think uplifting as well in 2015. At the same time, xenophobia, vilification of refugees and migrants has been growing. And that's becoming a big risk to there being safe reception, safe asylum for these people who are on the move and in many cases who are in such desperate need of help. That is something we're alarmed about. We think has to be countered. It really does require that politicians step up to the game, recognize the challenge of these times, and don't go down the route of dangerous populist tendencies, which put lots of lives at risk and don't really come to the point of looking at solutions to this situation.
Adrian Edwards is a spokesman for the UNHCR from Geneva. He spoke to VOA's Jody Capua. Italy's interior minister says his government has expelled 64 suspected Islamic extremists this year. Angelino Alfano says that when prosecutors lack evidence to try suspects in Italian courts, they expel them to prevent attacks on Italian soil. Also, Luxembourg Foreign Minister Jan Asselborn says the European Union needs to strengthen external border controls. He also says it should speed up resettlement decisions for migrants from the Middle East and Africa. However, Asselborn says the EU has improved in relocating migrants from Italy to Greece. You were listening to African News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Nineteen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Amnesty International says Burundi security forces systematically killed dozens of people in five capital city districts. Voters in Central African Republic have overwhelmingly backed a constitutional referendum aimed at ending nearly 3 years of political instability. And the UN says over a million people have fled to Europe this year. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at African News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. In the past 2 months, Nigerian and Cameroonian troops have freed hundreds of people in Nigeria who were being held captive by Boko Haram militants. Many are now living in an open-air transit camp in the northern Cameroonian town of Kolofata. Moki Edwin Kinzeka went there to meet them and has this report.
Heavy winds blow across this open air transit camp in Sabongari, a village on the border outside the town of Kolofata. The camp is now home to over 800 people displaced by the Boko Haram conflict. Among them is 56-year-old Nigerian Dada Aminatu. She fled her village near the town of Banki, less than 20 kilometers away, during a raid by the Cameroonian military this month. She says Boko Haram wouldn't let them leave their village. Their property and cattle were seized. She says the militants took the boys into the bush to their camps. She says she and other residents escaped amid gunfire during repeated raids by the Cameroonian military. She says some Boko Haram fighters escaped while others were killed or arrested. She says the village residents asked the military to take them to Cameroon for fear that Boko Haram would come back for revenge. Aminatu said some villagers are missing and believed to have been killed during the fighting. She says the Cameroonian soldiers did not assist the wounded. Some of the now displaced Nigerians accuse Cameroonian troops of burning huts and killing as many as 150 villagers during these operations, something the Cameroonian government has denied. Akemangeti, a Cameroonian troop commander in Kolofata, said the raids had been a success and will continue until Boko Haram is crushed.
Positively, we never lost any soldier here. We have killed many of the Boko Haram. For the present moment now, so we are controlling the position without any difficulties. So the situation now is very calm.
The officer said the former captives will remain in the transit camps until their villages are secure, but that negotiations are ongoing with the Nigerian government to resettle them. The governments of Cameroon and humanitarian agencies are taking care of the needs of the former hostages now, many of whom say they plan to stay in the camp for the time being. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Kolofata.
In Nigeria, the Sultan of Sokoto warns today that government actions taken against the Muslim population could radicalize the nation's large Muslim community. Sultan Umad Saad Abubakar made the statement more than a week after a deadly clash between Nigerian soldiers and followers of the Islamic movement of Nigeria in the Shia town of Zaria. The Sultan is president of the Nigerian Supreme Council for Islamic Affairs. Public protests by Muslims have been held in Kano and Kaduna since the Zaria incident. The army claims residents tried to assassinate Nigeria's army chief, General Tukar Buratai, when his convoy tried to pass through the town barricades. Residents denied the charges and said they were only throwing stones. The number of dead is widely disputed and ranges from 200 to 300. The army arrested the group's leader, Ibrahim Zakzaki, and some of the movement's followers. A spokesman for the movement claims that many who were detained are wounded and are not being given medical treatment. In other news, the UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, says continuing attacks by Boko Haram militants have forced more than a million children out of school in Nigeria and neighboring countries. UNICEF says more than 2,000 schools have been closed in Nigeria, Cameroon, Chad, and Niger. It says the militants have killed more than 600 teachers, looted many schools, and burned others. Hundreds of schools have reopened in recent months, but more than 11 million children of primary school age were already out of school due to 6 years of Boko Haram violence. In South Africa, the El Niño weather phenomenon has resulted in less rain and higher temperatures. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization says crop and livestock production are weaker. That's expected to contribute to higher food prices. The FAO says prices have been rising since last year's disappointing agricultural season in the region. It warns current conditions could acutely impact food security in the new year. The FAO says El Niño already has caused the maize planting season to be delayed in many parts of southern Africa, and crops that are growing are feeling the effects of lower rainfall and heat. The UN agency says the cropping season is now 6 weeks old and there's not enough moisture in the soil. It says the region's small-scale farmers are almost entirely dependent on rainfall. El Niño is expected to peak in early 2016. It's reported to be the strongest in 18 years. Malawi has released two men charged with sodomy. The move has sparked fierce debate as religious leaders and politicians accuse the government of bowing to demands from the international community. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Malawi suspended a law criminalizing homosexual acts in 2012, pending a parliament review. That law, which lays out maximum jail sentence of 14 years, was seen by some to be in conflict with the constitution, which calls for respect for human rights. But the parliamentary review never happened, and the law remains on the books. It was used to charge two men arrested on December 7. Those charges were dropped Saturday. Malawi's Justice Minister Samuel Tembenu says the law remains suspended.
We are responding to the concerns that people have had that we have breached our international obligations. So people were complaining, especially the international community.
International watchdog group Human Rights Watch and the American and German embassies had condemned the men's arrest. Religious leaders are now denouncing their unconditional release. Reverend Morris Montali is the spokesman for the Presbyterian Church in Livingstonia. He says homosexuality is a sin.
It is disgusting that a nation can succumb to the dictates of donors and in the process losing our identity, our spiritual trust, and our tradition.
Bide Banda, the director of a local good governance group, Malawi Watch, says the government took a rash decision. It would have been appropriate, he said, to push for an emergency session of parliament to decide once and for all on the anti-homosexuality law.
It is unfair, very unfair. When you're talking about human rights, we're not talking about minorities. There are majority rights issues as well. And what we're asking now, government must rescind that moratorium. It is uncultural.
The issue is quickly becoming a political hot potato for the ruling party. Spokesman for the lead opposition coalition, the Malawi Congress Party, reportedly told a local media the government should prioritize on the welfare of poor Malawians over issues involving one or two people. Political lecturer at the University of Malawi, Boniface Dulani.
When you look at the survey numbers, you see that up to 95% of Malawians disapprove of homosexuality. So one of the things that this decision can make is it also politically it might cost the government some support.
The government tried to strike a balance Saturday, releasing a statement that it is committed to reviewing the anti-homosexuality law, but with consultation with the people of Malawi. The public has resisted two previous attempts to change the homosexuality law. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, 2015 was an eventful year for Africa, with historic polls in Nigeria and Burkina Faso in what observers say is a new trend of democracy. U.S. President Barack Obama also journeyed to his father's homeland of Kenya and delivered a landmark speech at the African Union in Ethiopia. Also, Pope Francis preached a message of unity in his groundbreaking trip to the continent. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa Wednesday at 18:30 UTC when host Shaka Sali and his guests review the top stories of 2015 and a look ahead to 2016. That's next time on VOA Africa.
Looking for something? Headline news, interviews, analysis? We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America, and here is a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Voters in the Central African Republic have overwhelmingly backed a constitutional referendum to help end nearly 3 years of political instability. The UN says over a million people have fled to Europe this year. And in Nigeria, the Sultan of Sokoto warns that government actions against the Muslim population could radicalize the nation's largest Muslim community. Coming up, music from Burundi. And in our feature segment, an association of doctors in Nigeria say the government must do more to improve health care. I'm Yesu Ibenulai from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday, Yeheus.
Sunny, I understand you're kicking off with Ivory Coast football.
Yeheus, the Elephants of Ivory Coast are ending the year as Africa's top-ranked football team. In the December rankings released by FIFA, World Football's governing body, the Elephants are 19th overall and first in Africa. The Desert Foxes of Algeria are next at 28th overall, followed by the Black Stars of Ghana at number 33. In early February, Ivory Coast defeated neighbor Ghana 9-8 in a dramatic penalty kick shootout to lift the Africa Cup of Nations trophy for a second time in Bata, Equatorial Guinea. In this sunny side of sports highlight for 2015, let's look back on the Nations Cup triumph by Ivory Coast in Bata. There was definitely some deja vu in Bata. The same teams played for the Nations Cup trophy in 1992 when Ivory Coast, yes, prevailed in another marathon penalty kick shootout 11-10. The hero for Ivory Coast in the Bata shootout was goalkeeper Boubacar Barry, who converted the winning spot kick after making some crucial stops in front of the net. The shootout came after 120 minutes of scoreless football from the teams in a match of few scoring opportunities. The French coach for Ivory Coast, Hervé Renard, says the five previous matches in the tournament played by both squads may have taken a toll on both teams.
The game was very tough. I think two teams were a bit tired after five games and nobody wanted to attack. It's coming from God, it's coming from the luck. But you have also to be strong. I tried to tell them, even on penalty, it will be okay for us. It will be our time because it's the same like in 1992. I believe on the history and I'm a lucky coach.
Hervé Renard says he's a low-key coach. He danced shirtless with his players after the match. Renard is also a confident coach. During the tense penalty kick shootout, he could be seen on the sidelines smiling at the television cameras. And Renard is also a successful coach. He took charge of Ivory Coast after leading Zambia to the Nations Cup trophy in 2012. Meanwhile, his coaching counterpart for Ghana, Israeli tactician Avram Grant, says the Black Stars of Ghana were the better team in the Nations Cup final.
Even in this game against a team that have so many good players, we was the better side. They didn't create even one chance in 120 minutes. And all of this tournament, we scored a lot of goals. I think we scored the highest more than any team. We conceded less than any team. We did a lot of good things. And I think even we thought about the future, that I think everybody in Ghana can be proud in this team. They show a lot of good things.
Coach Avram Grant and the Black Stars of Ghana were hoping to win their first Nations Cup championship in 33 years. But alas, it was not to be after the heartbreaking loss in the shootout. Star striker Asamoah John says the Black Stars are disappointed, but also hopeful about the future.
We have no excuses now. We went to the penalty shootout and then we lost today. I think they've gone to the final on two occasions and then they've lost. And then this year they came back again to win it. You know, they went to penalty shootout, you know, for two times. And then this is the third time they went to penalty shootout in the final. And then they won, you know. So I'm very, very sad at the moment. Everybody is sad. But I don't regret our performance at all. I think we did so well in the competition. And then we are hoping, I think we've got a bright future because we've got young quality players.
This 2015 Nations Cup proved to be very challenging on the health front for Asamoah John. He missed Ghana's opening match because of malaria. And John also sat out Ghana's 3-0 victory over Equatorial Guinea in the semifinals after a player from Guinea stomped on his stomach during the quarterfinals. In more Nations Cup news, a few of Asamoah John's Ghana teammates won awards for their performances, as we hear now from our Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Auma.
Midfielder Christian Atsu got two awards, the Orange Man of the competition and the Nissan Goal of the tournament against Guinea. Andre Ayew was named Pepsi highest scorer, while Kwesi Appiah got the Samsung Fair Player of the tournament. The Democratic Republic of Congo won the Fair Play Prize. Earlier, the Democratic Republic of Congo edged Equatorial Guinea 4-2 in a post-match penalty shootout in the bronze medal playoff. Penalty kicks followed as the teams were deadlocked at 0-0 in open play.
Ivorian football star Yaya Toure had a superb late goal for Manchester City on Monday, but it was too little too late. Man City fell to host Arsenal 2-1 in London in a battle of English Premier League leaders. Toure delivered a superb finish into the top corner of the net in the 82nd minute. The Gunners of Arsenal got first half goals from Theo Walcott and Olivier Giroud. Taking a look at the top of the EPL table, Arsenal now has 36 points from 17 matches, putting the Gunners 2 points behind the first-place Foxes of Leicester, who have been one of the big surprise packages in the Premier League this season. Man City has 32 points from 17 matches. Now let's take a look at the Premier League scoring leaders. Those Foxes of Leicester have a real dynamic duo this season. Jamie Vardy and the Algerian Riyad Mahrez. Together, they've combined for 28 goals. Vardy has a league-leading 15 goals, while Mahrez has 13 goals. The Belgian Romelu Lukaku of Everton also has 13 goals. And Nigerian striker Odion Ighalo of Watford is next with 12 goals. Ighalo had a big game over the weekend. He knocked in 2 goals as Watford beat Liverpool 3-0. Watford has 28 points in the EPL standings, while Liverpool has 24 points.
Hey, g'day, mates. Remember me? This is the old sports emperor with a red-hot listening tip. That's right. Give a listen to my pal, the bright and lively Sunny Man on the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. Dr. Larry Zamoja here, Chairman, Chief Executive, Sports Radio 88.9 Brila FM. Keep getting sporty sunshine with Sunny Young. We all do at Sports Radio 88.9 Brila FM, broadcasting out of the cities of Lagos, Abuja, Kaduna, and Onitsha in Nigeria, as well as the World Wide Web on www.brilafm.net. I tell you this. It's always a thrill, yes, a thrill, to remain on the sunny side on Brilla with Sunny. Keep listening, Africa.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny side of
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the sunny side of sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
They're playing basketball. We love that basketball.
In National Basketball Association news, all-star point guard John Wall has led my favorite club, the Washington Wizards, to their 12th victory of the season. Wall showed off his passing skills, notching a career-high 19 assists and scoring 12 points as the Wizards beat the visiting Sacramento Kings 113-99. The game was played at the Verizon Center Arena, located just a few blocks from our Voice of America headquarters here in Washington. Polish center Marcin Gortat scored 27 points and grabbed 16 rebounds for the Wizards, while teammate Garrett Temple added a career-high 23 points. The Wizards have struggled with injuries this season, but I'm confident once they get healthy, they'll turn in some magical performances. Speaking of magic, the Orlando Magic were winners Monday night, scoring a 107-99 road victory over the New York Knicks. Orlando center Nikola Vucevic tied his season high with 26 points, and he also had 9 rebounds. Vucevic was born in Switzerland, moved to Montenegro when he was a teenager, and he played college basketball at the University of Southern California. So I guess you can call him a true international player. Now let's go to San Antonio, Texas, where the 5-time NBA champion San Antonio Spurs remained unbeaten at home this season with a 106-92 victory over the Indiana Pacers. Kawhi Leonard had 24 points for the Spurs, who improved to 16-0 at home this season. Overall, San Antonio has 24 wins and 5 losses, the second-best start in club history. Also in Texas, the Houston Rockets defeated the visiting Charlotte Hornets 102-95. Star guard James Harden, who I think has my favorite beard in basketball, scored 36 points for the Rockets. In Chicago, the Brooklyn Nets snapped a 5-game losing streak with a 105-102 victory over the Chicago Bulls. Brooke Lopez had 21 points and 12 rebounds for the Nets. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to you, Hayes Wuhi.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Friday, Sonny is an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 UTC, right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, an association of doctors in Nigeria says the government must do more to improve health care. And next, interactive apps teaching young children about different African cultures. But first, some music. Here is Kidum from Burundi with Abambuzi.
Om Dafer, Gango Yusufu Matoma, Yahya Hussein, Papa Grace, Charles Ogada, Digital Entertainment Promotion. Ah, c'est ça. Mama Kibido, Maurice Oyano. Todie, todie.
C'est pas moi, ça va, c'est jour.
pamba wisera kandi wachiwa mamoko itewe kesi na mungu samara bitumwa kesi niki ya babu jamarongo mesi ineka vizosa ya mpamuwa ugasigara widoga wichuza kwesiyo menya kanura mushinga naye kanura mufasoni yisi sibe nyigise abantu bundi batifina abambuzi ntabara bufise agutera kesi utiteguye
Papa Grasso Wami maso kukusika mituna jawe
Kariyo kinomu
Umera makabano jambo mokono razasi
Wirinde
Wirinde Wirinda bambuzi
Bambuzi, bambuzi
Wirinde, wirinda basura, basura, basura
Mutko abiri yakuya
Muse wigeru ya yata
Mutko hawe ni mana
Muse wigeru twancho twako
Numviri sanchuti anje umugisho tangwa ni mana Babambuzi basa kwisi na kari barusenya zuki busa Ulivyo rero roja mumu kono razusi Ineka bizosa ya we nikute ya unye Kanura musinga na ye Kanura mufasoni Yisi si minyigisi Ala nubo nima kifina Ala muzi tavara wafise Akutera kesu titekuye
Mauko ilinda wambuzi
Akati aritika wakasema
Wame maso kukusika mituna jawe
Kandi kabiri karatiko
Mera makabalu jambo mokono razasi
Heza umwibutsa
wirinde wirinda bambuzi
aho
wirinde wirinda basura basura basura
imitwe tirarira sikuza 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 tambo kwenye
Burundi's Kidum with Abambuzi. An association of doctors in Nigeria say the government must do more to improve access and affordability of healthcare in Africa's most populous country. Chris Stein reports with Ibrahima Yakuba in Kaduna, Nigeria.
Nigerian Medical Association President Kayode Obembe says Nigeria's doctors are overstretched. He estimates there is one doctor for every 6,000 patients in Nigeria, a ratio far and above World Health Organization recommendations. And many of Nigeria's medical school graduates go overseas, he says. Those that stay in the country tend to live in cities, not in the rural areas where they are also needed.
We still need to put more efforts
so that we can get more doctors, and not just getting more doctors, to ensure that they are evenly distributed to take care of every part of the community.
Samuel Ulumakan is a doctor in the northern city of Kaduna who teaches at a local medical school. He says doctors in Nigeria are poorly paid and hospitals lack proper equipment. Many doctors decide they would rather work in another country.
Some of them don't like to work at home because even the country itself cannot meet up with their needs, salary and other things.
But even though some people want to be doctors, the high cost of education and training keeps many people from going to medical school, Olamakan says.
We are calling the federal government to help us to be given admission as much as possible so that the numbers of doctors in Nigeria will be increased and all these challenges we are facing will be reduced.
The end result is that people in rural areas who lack access to doctors often rely on family members or poorly trained pharmacists when they get sick, Olamakan said. At a meeting held last week, the Nigerian Medical Association called for the government to levy a tax on cigarettes, alcohol, and cell phone credits. Obembe says that money could pay for a national health insurance plan so poor people can afford preventative medical care. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
Africa represents less than 1% of the multi-billion dollar gaming industry, but smartphones and the internet give young software developers the ability to catch up to the rest of the world. Adebayo Agbembo created Genie Games Limited in Nigeria's capital, Abuja. He talks to VOA's Jackson Mfunganyi about his collection of interactive apps to teach young children about different African cultures.
Genie Games is the parent entity behind the Asha brand. Asha means culture in Yoruba, and it is a range of interactive mobile applications and web videos that are geared towards promoting and preserving our indigenous African cultures, primarily among kids. So it started out in February of 2012.
Okay.
As one application, and then in 2013, you know, we formally incorporated the company, which is Genie Games. So it became a business then.
You started out with one app. How many apps do you have right now?
Presently, we have about a dozen applications that touch on different aspects, languages, and whole fields.
And who is your target market?
So our target are actually primarily African kids here in Africa and the diaspora. And then secondary for anyone who's keen to find out about, you know, different areas of African culture.
Can you imagine, such a big continent, very diverse, with hundreds of cultures. How many have you been able to capture so far?
So far, we started out with Nigeria and touched on three major cultures, Yoruba, Hausa, Igbo. We've also touched on some other cultures like Efik, using our folktales, for example, to help people understand a bit about their dressing and things like that.
And these apps are based on what type of platforms?
Okay, so presently we have them available for iOS, which are iPhones and iPads, and also Android devices.
But how many young kids between the ages of 2 and 12 in Nigeria or in Africa have access to those type of devices that where they would be able to access these apps?
Okay, so what we've seen, again, the way that we're going about this is actually targeting the parents, because the parents have access to these devices. And with what we've seen so far, you know, the bulk of our users are actually in the diaspora. And those ones have disposable income and have access to these devices. So with regards to the African market, you know, we're looking at, you know, taking the whole thing, to making it the web, making them available on the web to reach them, which is why we went into videos, you know, beyond starting up with the application. So I would say in terms of, you know, the mobile app versions, they're primarily targeted at those in the diaspora.
The ones in the diaspora would be the ones more in need of learning these cultures, right?
Yes, that's what we've seen so far in 3 years of doing this. We've seen that it's more of a pain to Africans in the diaspora because they are the ones most connected from the root cultures, and they are the ones who are even willing to pay to have access to this thing.
Now, it seems to me that you are at a cusp of a new thing here, a new industry, the gaming industry on the African continent. How is that growing?
Well, it's on two sides. On the part of the developers, it's actually growing. We have a number of them besides myself who are building applications around games. And in terms of the users, I think the beautiful thing is it's turning out to be you know, the one thing that we can use to drive other content, because it appeals to everyone. I mean, people want to be entertained, people want to relax. So, I mean, there's a growing appeal from, you know, from the youth and also from the part of the developers. It's also catching up.
Also, in terms of reach, how many people in terms of numbers have you been able to reach?
So far, I would say at least 100,000 of them.
Okay, 100,000. And what is your target?
In terms of our target, you know, our goal is to be able to reach as many Africans in diaspora as possible. And we know that there are millions of them. You know, and we won't be able to reach them because they are the ones most affected by this disconnect between the root culture and, you know, their kids over there. You know, so in terms of our target, we want to be the one-stop shop for African cultural content for those in the diaspora in the next 5 years.
Creator of Genie Games Limited, Adebayo Agibembo, speaking with VOA's Jackson and Funganye. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Ruhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanov. Thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The United States is determined to disrupt the illicit flow of money from the trade of oil and trafficking of antiquities to the terrorist group Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL. Toward this end, the U.S. Department of State's Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $5 million for information leading to the significant disruption of the sale and or trade of oil and antiquities by, for, on behalf of, or to benefit ISIL. Through its illegal oil operations and trafficking in looted archaeological material from Syria and Iraq, ISIL has generated millions of dollars in hard currency, enabling it to brutalize and oppress innocent civilians. This is the first time the U.S. Secretary of State has authorized a Rewards for Justice offer for information that could be used to disrupt the sale or trade in oil and antiquities by or on behalf of a terrorist organization. Anyone with information on oil and antiquities trafficking that benefits ISIL can contact the Rewards for Justice office via the website at www.rewardsforjustice.net or by email at info@rewardsforjustice.net or by standard mail at Rewards for Justice, Washington, D.C., 20520-0303. USA. Individuals in North America can also call this phone number, 1-800-877-3927. All information will be kept strictly confidential. The Rewards for Justice program is administered by the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Diplomatic Security. Since its inception in 1984, the program has paid in excess of $125 million to more than 80 people who provided actionable information that put terrorists behind bars or prevented acts of international terrorism worldwide. Follow us on Twitter at https://twitter.com/rewardsforjustice, as in the numeral 4.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, 2015 was an eventful year for Africa, with historic polls in Nigeria and Burkina Faso in what observers say is a new trend of democracy. U.S. President Barack Obama also journeyed to his father's homeland of Kenya and delivered a landmark speech at the African Union in Ethiopia. Also, Pope Francis preached a message of unity in his groundbreaking trip to the continent. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa Wednesday at 18:30 UTC when host Shaka Sali and his guests review the top stories of 2015 and a look ahead to 2016. That's next time on VOA Africa.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views. Presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.